Good evening. I think I was chosen to introduce our speaker simply because I am a lifelong New Yorker. And indeed, I must say that that was a wise choice by our library, because I can report to all of you that despite having spent 62 years crawling, walking, and running on the sidewalks of New York, on reading, on looking, I've learned an enormous amount of data about our streets I never knew before. Like that the hills that did not fit Olmsted and Vaux's plan for Central Park were lopped and transformed into the blocks that now form the wall around the park today. That the hard Manhattan schist, did I pronounce that correctly? Rock, that hard Manhattan schist rock that lies right below the surface, downtown and midtown, but is buried more deeply in the intermediate streets, therefore influenced the location of Manhattan skyscrapers. That squirrels can fit through a hole the size of a quarter. That resident rats in the basement of a building can tell the difference between people who speak English and those who speak Spanish, and thus which of the two are more likely to be a mortal threat. That resident New Yorkers pass each other on crowded sidewalks by doing the step and slide, while suburbanites walk straight forward as if they were SUVs. And that the J in jaywalking means a silly person. All this and a lot more one can learn in onlooking 11 walks with expert eyes. Alexandra takes 11 walks, mostly in her Manhattan neighborhood, with experts such as an urban sociologist, a geologist, a physician, and a sound engineer. She also walks with a child, a dog, and a blind woman. I learned an amazing amount about the mysteries of human perception. No wonder. In addition to studying sidewalks, Alexandra is an adjunct associate professor in the psychology department of Barnard College. She is currently testing the olfactory acuity of domestic dogs. Indeed, she is the author of a former number one New York Times bestseller, Inside of a Dog. I present to you Alexandra Horowitz.
Thank you. Well, now you really know about the book already, actually. He hit a lot of the high points. Thank you very much for having me. I love to speak here, and especially in this room, where we can otherwise never speak. It's really fun to be in front of a microphone. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this book, and the place I wanted to start, since it's about onlooking, is with our eyes. And this is a picture of the back of the eye, and it shows the retina and all the veins converging at what is called the optic nerve. And the optic nerve is what feeds from the retina into the brain, and so sends all the information from the photoreceptor cells of the retina that are telling us what we see into the brain. So it's an interesting place in the eye, because where the optic nerve goes through the retina, there are no photoreceptor cells. So whatever is in that little hole in the back of our eye on the visual field, we can't see. This is called the visual blind spot. We all have this. This is an extremely normal thing. It's a very strange design for an eye, but that's the way it is. And what is so striking about it is that we never see it, you know. Our brain fills in that space that corresponds to whatever is in that little hole in our retina. So I'm interested in the kind of metaphoric blind spot that we all have. In other words, the things that we're looking at or that we're staring straight at, but we're not seeing at all. So a little backstory into how I got into this. As was described, I teach at Barnard, and I work in the psychology department, and I study dog cognition. So I look at these animals' behavior with an idea of making some inference about what they know, because dogs, like most animals, are very reticent about telling us themselves, unlike humans. I study their play behavior. Right now I'm looking at their olfactory behavior, how they sniff. I studied their vocalizations. I look at what's called their social cognition, how they deal with each other and with humans. And I wrote about this all in my first book, Inside of a Dog. And my interest was in trying to overthrow the common attributions we make of dogs and instead replace that set of understanding with one based on what it might be like to actually be a dog, based on their sensation and cognition. So back to the blind spot. When I started studying dogs in the late 90s, almost no one was studying the cognition of dogs in science. I was in a comparative psychology program. We were interested in animal mind, but nobody was looking at dogs. Why not? They're so available. You know, they're so easy to get a hold of. So I've puzzled over this a little bit, and I think there are two reasons for that. One, because everyone was looking at primates. We're a primate, and we figured the most interesting next species to look at is a chimpanzee or a bonobo, and of course they are very interesting. But dogs actually are better than them at a lot of social cognitive tasks. But I think the more important thing is that dogs are not exotic. Dogs seem to be known by us. They're familiar to us. And at least that's what we thought. And it's those things which are so familiar that we stop looking at, and we don't think we have to ask any more questions about them. So in my dog research, that's what I'm fascinated by. All those things we think are obvious, the guilty look of dogs, for instance, I'm looking again at that behavior. And there's some surprising richness there. So in this book, On Looking, I'm doing actually a very similar thing. I took dozens of walks, actually, with people around the block, as it were, and all these people had different expertise or were constitutionally different, such that they had different ways of seeing the world. And I asked them to tell me what they saw. The result was that, again, that something that was familiar to me, my city, New York City, revealed itself to have layers and interest that I had overlooked, just as we had with dogs. So, of course, I got the specific idea about walking together from dogs. As anyone who lives with dogs, I take a lot of walks around the block with dogs. In fact, I've lived with dogs in a city for maybe 22 years, and I take maybe a couple walks a day around the block, and so that's about 1,000 a year. That's about 22,000 walks in the city, a lot. And one tends to not be very excited about these walks. But over the years, over time, even before I started studying them as a research subject, I realized that I'd gotten a little bit inside of my dog's head. I'd gotten interested in what my dogs were looking at and what they saw and how that diverged from what I saw when we were on that walk together. So I began to see what was interesting on the walk to my dogs. And any sidewalk that didn't have a fire plug on it, or a tree, or another dog or person approaching, became boring to me as well. And for instance, you know, this is the beginning of our walk together, or it was the beginning of my walk with one of my dogs, an entrance to Riverside Park, and is obvious what we all see here. You know, we see a wall, and it is that schist, actually, from the foundation of Manhattan, wrought into a wall. And I could tell you a good amount about that history of this park and this staircase and what we see in the background. Actually, New Jersey is in the distance, and we see all that. But I wondered what the dog was seeing, right? So I just stayed there for a few minutes and took pictures. And this is what the dog seemed to be looking at. And this is, of course, why. This is the key to me, that exactly what I think is obvious about that scene is different when you are a different species, in this case, an olfactory species who's focused on the smells of the environment and not on the visual scene. So I wondered, what else am I missing on my walks in the city that others see, not just other species, but other people who have, as I say, this different constitution or expertise. So I was going for what scene was kind of hidden in plain sight in front of us, the ordinary things that we all are missing in our rush to get to the train or get to work with our minds on our errands or what we're going to do next. As much as I'm a kind of professional observer, I realized I had stopped entirely looking at the streets around me. This is really easy to do in some contexts, like when you visit a new place, when we go on vacation. So we head to the tourist spots maybe, but we also notice the details on the way there. So we see that the streets are wider and narrower, and that's so enjoyable to us. Look, a narrow street, you know, or the trees are taller, or the buildings are shorter, or people's pants are 3 inches shorter than wherever we're from. So I wanted to get in that mindset of being on vacation, and I did that with my tool of having other people walk me through what they saw. And this is the kind of approach that I take with my dog that I'm going to take with this book. There was a gentleman named Jakob von Uxkull, who was a German biologist in the early 20th century, who was interested in other animals' perspectives and what he called their Umwelt, their worldview. And again, with the dog, the Umwelt is going to be defined by what it smells. So he tried to draw some pictures of this, and I'm going to draw some pictures of you today of what we saw that are like this. Here he drew a picture of, I guess, what is a very standard early 20th century German sitting room with all the things highlighted that a human would be expected to see. And then he just highlighted in pink, you can almost see, barely, you can just barely see, up here, the light and the plates, the places that he thought the fly, a house fly, would experience in that room. And my son did not want to come to the talk, apparently. My first complainer. And the rest of the room is basically invisible to the fly. To a dog, he thought these elements that were reddened were the only ones the dog saw, the places that humans had been or the places food had been, essentially. So this is the approach that I'm going to take, trying to see from the different vantages of all these minds. So I began my investigation here, from the eye to the earth. And I started looking closer. Until we zoomed all the way in and we got to my block. Amazingly, we've become kind of accustomed to this zoom from space, thanks to Google. But we've forgotten to zoom in one more level. And that's where my book comes in. My zoom lens isn't a kind of instrument. It was just the bringing of a certain sort of attention to the details, the visible details, not the microscopic details that were around us, and loitering there to see the history of the details, to see what they tell us about the place, to see what they tell us about perception or about attention. So I began by taking a walk around the block where I lived and noting what I saw. And then I took dozens of walks with different people, geologists, sound engineer, a blind woman, an insect tracker, a topographer, and a dog. These folks were my lens to notice something. And they all surprised me at some level in what they saw. Let me bring attention to one element of the scene to practice what Arthur Conan Doyle called in his drawing of Sherlock Holmes, the observation of trifles. You know, Doyle was influenced in his, as you may know, in his design of Holmes by his medical professor, Dr. Bell, who had an astute ability to look at a person and diagnose their profession, essentially. So, for instance, looking at somebody who had a hobbling gait and who had trousers worn on the inside of the knee, he could tell that that person was a cobbler because the cobbler wears the lapstone against his knee for his craft. So I'm going to give you a few examples of the trifles that we saw. I started right around the corner. And the first walk I took was with Paul Shaw, who was a topographer, a calligrapher, a designer, a all-around kind of letterphiliac, somebody who could see letters everywhere and who seeks letters everywhere. So I'm doing a kind of von Uxkull Umwelt approach here, highlighting what each walker saw. So he didn't see the rest of the scene, essentially. He just saw the places that might have letters. And what's wonderful about this is that we weren't looking at the letters for what they read. We were looking at the letters for their history, for their design, and for what they tell us about the person who put the letter there. So what Paul showed me was essentially the diversity of and humor of the letters in the city. This big-nosed P was on our walk. Here was a squinty B, a kind of jolly E. I think this is a tipsy G, and a Q with an inverted belly button, essentially. It's hard to find anything unique in this Word doc font world, but this was a unique font even for him. And two, the type of lettering told us not just about the kind of business or building that wore it on its face, but also told us a little bit about the history of the construction of the city. In fact, you could recreate a little bit of the history of construction of the city by looking at lettering. As Paul told me and we saw, there's a lot of Art Deco and Art Moderne on building faces, and that represents that in the 20s and 30s, there was a large amount of construction of the quality that endures to today. So you can do a lot of detectiving from lettering alone. This building's lettering puzzled us. It's along the top here. This is in the Lower East Side. You might know what it is. It's almost illegible until we read it from an angle, from the street corner, basically, as if speaking to someone from the corner, come and visit us. This is a gallery storefront for art and architecture. Come look in here. And this led me to learn about a class of art, actually, featuring this technique called anamorphosis. An image is rendered so as to be visible, legible, or comprehensible, to be precise, from an oblique vantage, not from a straight-on, full frontal perspective. As famously, as Simon Winchester discussed here not so long ago, Holbein's The Ambassadors of 1533, with its memento mori, this part of the image at the bottom, which is extremely peculiar, if we focus in on it, and then we approach it from the side. This painting was meant to be against stairways, so it would be seen by people ascending the stairs. This is the image. Same exact phenomenon as the lettering on the street. Basically unnoticed. Here's some more anamorphic work. This is from a gentleman named Felice Verini. On the right, you see the pieces of this installation, which don't make sense from most vantages, but from one specific vantage, come together. And here's another one that he did in Paris at an art and technical school, showing the lines which are sort of deconstructed in preparation. That was Paul Shaw. I walked with Charlie Eisman, who I call an insect tracker, but really he's a field naturalist, keen not just on finding insects, but what he also called the mystery little objects that they leave behind, the spore, or what's called the sign of insects. So we were looking at all the places where insects might live, and although I've highlighted the sidewalk cracks and the living areas and the tree pits below the trees, you know, I'm sorry to tell you that insects are on every surface, basically, that we approached. So there wasn't just one place we looked. I contacted him after reading a good amount of his field guide to invertebrate sign, which you might not have picked up, but it's actually a quite wonderful and exhaustive tome about the types of leavings that indicate that insects have been or are living there. But what made me think that this was interesting fodder for investigation in a city was that in the book he describes that he and his co-author stopped right at the beginning of their tour to go to all the national parks to look for insect sign at the house of his co-author's mother in Tennessee. And after she had said her goodbyes, 5 hours later, she emerged from her house to find the two of them still in the driveway, turning over leaves and logs. They had already found their wilderness, basically. And so I figured the city would be a pretty fertile place to look. And sure enough, it was. I quickly learned the great strategy to find insect sign, and I will reveal it to you now, which is flip things over. A leaf or a rock or any kind of thing shows what insect is living there. And what we found was alarming. For every space, there was a bug. My favorite sign that we came across was this. It might not be obvious. This is why I brought the lens of someone who could read this tree trunk and see what we saw, which was this path representing these jagged little marks are the radula, the teeth scraping of a slug, which traveled along here and ate its way the top layer of algae or bark or whatever was on this tree. Just an ordinary tree, just any tree in the city that it had visited. Similarly, this was not a very auspicious looking wood cutting, but with this new vision that just being with Charlie gave me, I zoomed in a little closer. And I saw that it was entirely covered with ladybug pupae, the chrysalis left when the adult flies away. So on every surface, I realized bugs existed. And one needn't be an expert in insect sign to kind of benefit from this knowledge. One of the things I found in New York City that was most revealing was that you could distinguish the native from the invasive species of trees by simply doing that leaf-flipping behavior, because the invasive trees have very clean, dry, clean-looking leaves. They don't have a bug population which has come to feature them yet, which lives in that tree. But all the native trees have loads of bugs which specialize in living on that particular tree. So it's a very easy way to tell how old a tree is in our city. I walked with my then 19-month-old son. I was interested in what he saw at 2 feet off the ground and without an adult's sensibility. I wasn't exactly prepared to have my conceptual understanding of what it means to go for a walk rocked. But it was, because for me, a walk was a kind of simple matter. I didn't have to navigate with all these people I was walking with what it meant to go for a walk. You're going from A to B, and you might stop along the way, but you're basically walking a path. Of course, not for a child, right? A walk, according to my toddler, was regularly about not walking. It had nothing to do with points A or B or the getting from one to the other. Instead, it was a kind of investigatory exercise that began with energy and ended when exhausted. It began in the elevator, coming through the lobby, and then stopping on the steps for 10 minutes. It actually began before the elevator, when we're tying our shoes, or when we're doing the going down the hall to tie our shoes march. He was miles into his walk when we just stepped out the door. And it was also exploring surfaces with your fingers or your toes or I'm sorry to say, your tongue. It was trying out different forms of locomotion. It was running and spinning and shuffling and galloping. It was stopping to look at the candy wrappers that are dropped on the ground. It was stopping to stand in the breeze and watch the paper bag go aloft. It was stopping to point. To share. And this is some of the stuff that he shared with me. Standpipes. Well, you've seen these, of course. This isn't new, but have you looked at them? Because we spend a lot of time with standpipes, which are just at that height. I now know that there are 5 standpipes on my block. That's because there are 5 6-story or greater buildings on my block, and I now know that they're actually mandated for any building in Manhattan, which is 6 stories or greater, because they are, you probably know, a backup water source for fire hoses. They come in lots of different varietals, 2-headed, 1-headed, sometimes 3-headed, differently capped with chains. They're really wonderful pets. He showed me this, which, again, sort of like with the dog, I didn't really see what he was seeing until he told me that there were a number of O's and a Y and a T. In the time he was really learning about O's, And there are O's everywhere. You know, there are O's on stop signs and license plates, and there are O's on air conditioner backs and in holes in the sidewalk. And we stop seeing this at some point. Again, not a very auspicious-looking place to stop, but he was really hell-bent on these acute isosceles triangles because you could step on one side and walk up to the other and leap off. And so we really examined the geometry of the block together. And what he showed me, essentially, were all the things that I can see but that I've stopped seeing. These are not things I didn't know about. These are things I no longer open my eyes to. That is part of growing up, and I want to lose that again, actually. I walked with Arlene Gordon, who is blind. So I actually want to see what she sees when she goes on a walk. She uses what's called a long cane, and she taps it a few steps in front of her. Can you see where she is? Because with that tap, she can. The tap of the cane draws a picture for her, a kind of sound picture. And she, like an echolocating little brown bat, listens to the sound coming back at her and draws a picture of the space around her. So she saw us approaching this awning with her cane, because as you approach, the sound bounces differently off the underside of the awning and comes back at you clipped. You might have noticed that under an awning, you can hear people around you talking suddenly more. They're not talking more loudly. The sound is bouncing back differently. What I found enjoyable about her perspective, about what she saw, is that I too could hear this, right? But it's not what I pay attention to. So I could exactly notice the differences she did, but for her, she not only attended, but allowed it to draw the picture that I lazily, with my eyes, see. A lot of people are annoyed by cell phone users on the sidewalk, but for Arlene Gordon, these people are beacons of where other people are on the street. So she enjoyed their presence approaching and retreating from her, and only doesn't like the texters. Another way of seeing that Gordon perfected that she told me about, and incidentally, she didn't think she had any supersensory ability at all. And in some ways, she's right, but she's refined her attention to these other modalities, was her sense of touch. Over the last 40 or so years that she has been blind, she became blind half her lifetime ago, she has traveled the world, usually with friends. And in all these places, she gathers mementos or souvenirs, which she calls her pictures. And when I visited, if we finished the walk and I visited her house, there were hundreds of these lining her shelves, and I picked one up, and I handed it to her, and she fingered it for a second and pulled out a visual memory. This is a box with a flower on its lid, and it was from a visit to China in a hot summer. She could see it. It was just with her fingers. Of course, we use this almost not at all when we're out in the world. I walked with John Hadidian. He is a wildlife expert. And so we were interested in the places on a city street where wildlife like to be, and that's usually just the places where humans aren't, the places between human activity, the between spaces. So for instance, we saw this wonderful thing, which was this gap between these buildings. These are two large apartment buildings, and we noticed something that looked like a brick that was being thrown out of the wall and then being thrown back into the wall. And we looked a little closer, and what we could see were sparrows who had built their nests there in the 2 inches between the buildings. They had built an apartment house themselves and were residing there. And I've since seen that this is actually not at all uncommon through the city. If you have a space, an animal will fill it. And that represents how there is so much urban wildlife, and there is a huge amount. That's because they live in this parallel universe using our homes, our food. I mean, they are there because we are here. In fact, there's a kind of theory called the urban cliff hypothesis that we have recreated in our man-made environment and ersatz cliffs, rock cliffs, that mimic in some ways the types of cliffs that we evolved into in the Homo erectus way back. Lived at caves with cliffs above them, which housed all the same animals that now live in the city with us, rats and birds and raccoons and raptors and squirrels. Sound familiar? So we're still creating, we're creating that environment. These animals will always live with us as long as we keep recreating that past natural environment. I took what I think of as a smell walk with my dog, Finnegan. And so he was interested in, of course, the places that groaned with the smell of the passage of other dogs. And we spent a lot of time, I'm sorry to say, at these balusters. And I could talk forever about the dog's experience of the block. It's something very interesting to me. But I will say just this about it. And we know that dogs have a very good sense of smell. But if you watch their sniffing, you get the distinct impression that each baluster's scent is quite different. Otherwise, why would you have to visit every one if allowed, right? They're telling the tales of different passing dogs. And two, they're telling the tale of passing time. For that we know that a dog can distinguish a difference in concentration of an odor between the first and fifth footstep of a departing person. And certainly the difference in concentration of a scent on the first, second, or third baluster if visited by the same scent lever. So that actually gives us some indication of the direction in which the last dog has gone. And if you watch your dog smelling, if you have a dog and let them loiter and smell, you'll see that they sniff, 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 and then look up, looking to find the visual correspondence to the smell. He also pulled me to an unfamiliar doorway, which was not, it was not my doorway, and it was just somebody else's home, and we he insisted we stay there, and I was letting him lead my way. I like to do this often, to let him lead with the nose. But we were really letting him take all priority. 3 minutes later, out came a woman I recognized from morning dog walks in the city. And she was taking her charge out for a midday relief, and apparently had just gone in a few minutes before. So the dog could smell that she had recently entered. And then, satisfied that she appeared, he wandered off. I walked with Sidney Horenstein, who is a geologist. And you might not think that there's a lot of geology in the city, but for Sidney, everything is essentially minerals or biomass. So everything in the city, if it's not people walking, turns out to be a kind of mineral, a version, man-made or not, man-hewn or not, I should say, of stone. And so you walk down the street and it is transformed into a kind of cacophonous overlay of stone from different eras, different locations, all put together at once in the same neighborhood. One of my favorite things we found, this was the building where I started my walks, is a limestone building, as many buildings in the city are. But I had never looked in my thousands of entrances and exits to this building just a little closer at the limestone to see that actually it had these kind of seashells in them, which housed pelecypods and crinoids, little discs, which are actually the remains of animals that lived in the seafloor or settled on the seafloor in an ancient ocean 300 million years ago in what is now Indiana, and now are preserved as limestone, and in fact, the constituent of limestone. So unless the limestone has been well raked on the surface of a building, you can approach any limestone building and see an extraordinary array of ancient fossils. We also saw these guys. This is not a little short wall. It's a short wall in front of a little garbage mezzanine in front of a building that I would have stopped at. But these are actually ancient worm tracks from that same time. So these are tracks where a worm went through the sediment, and it then hardened 300 million years ago. That surprised me. Walking with Sid, I noticed him discreetly kind of smiling and nodding this way and that, and he was really smiling at what he calls his friends. That's how he thinks of the various stony spirits around him. And there are many. You know, the stone you see on the sidewalk is different from that on the curb, it's different from that on the street, it's different from that around the tree pit and the steps leading up to the brownstone and on the face of the building and often on the decorative elements of the building. Those all have different histories, and that was revealing to see. I walked with Fred Kent, who was an urban sociologist. He worked in the mid-20th century with a guy named William Holly White, who was very interested in looking at movement of people and the social life of people in a city. And so we looked at how pedestrians navigated, how we navigate together in the city. As we were walking along Broadway in a very busy street, Kent shouted over to me, "We don't bump other people." And that's usually true, even in the very busiest streets of Midtown, at least not full frontal, you know, hugging bumps. And so we looked at why this happens. Most of our pedestrian behavior, as the researchers describe it, is quick and fluid, and it's mostly unconscious. We do these little moves to get out of the way of others, and we do them mutually. And the result is extreme amount of traffic behavior that runs smoothly. Well, we can learn from fish on this. As it turns out, research on ant swarming and bird flocking, and especially fish schooling, tells us that there are just a couple of simple rules that fish follow in order to not constantly crash into each other. And we follow the same rules. The first one is align with each other. Keep up with those next to you. The next one is avoid. So you keep a little bit of personal space around you. And this varies by animals. Fish have smaller personal space than we do. But stay comfortably close to each other. So that's how we avoid bumping. And the next is attract. Stay with others and follow whoever is in front of you. Fish tend to follow directly behind each other. We tend to follow right over the shoulder, looking right over the shoulder of the person in front of us. And whoever that leader is doesn't need to know where they're going. The leadership changes as soon as you turn. But if we follow each other and we stay together and we avoid, we keep a little space, traffic flows smoothly. So what Fred and I noticed is that there are, of course, violations to this rule. There are two major violators. One are the texters. And the reason is that they are not even using their ancient fish brains. They don't even look at all. And you need to at least have your eyes open to do this dance. And the second are the tourists. And that's because we have become expert at doing this navigation, and they are looking up. And now I admire them for looking up, because that's the one thing we never do, but you have to step out of the way. I also took another walk where we looked at people, and this was with a doctor named Bennett Lorber, and I also did an ancillary walk with my own physical therapist. Bennett is a doctor who specializes in making physical diagnoses. In other words, he's interested in what a person's approach and their manner and their handshake can tell him about their health before you take their blood or hook them up to any machines. So we looked at people on the street as though they were approaching us for a diagnosis. And in fact, he saw somebody who needed hip surgery and another person with a stenotic spine. And based on their gaits, the way you could see that their gait was shortened. And even a person with a genetic disorder on the 23rd chromosome based on their facial configuration. I have spared sharing with you, and I think the Society Library would approve of this, what he and others also smell about other people, and that is they smell disease. Diseases smell. We are, of course, always giving off a huge amount of smell, whether we like it or not, but the diseased cell smells. So this was an approach typically of the 19th century physician to smell a patient to get a sense of what the disease was, but Bennett likes to smell the aspirated tissue of a patient to still get that information in addition to the other tests that he runs. It tells him something. And so were very distinct smells. So in the 19th century, what were called lunatics apparently smelled like yellow deer or mice. I don't know what yellow deer or mice smelled like, but like lunatics, I guess. Typhoid smelled like freshly baked brown bread. The measles smelled like fresh picked feathers. Tuberculosis was reminiscent of stale beer. And diabetics smelled like extremely rotten sweet fruit. We didn't do much smelling of other people. I refrained on this walk, but I'm tempted. Finally, I walked with an artist, Myra Kalman. You might know her from some New Yorker covers many New Yorker covers that she has drawn. And she had an exhibit at the Jewish Museum not so long ago. And I was interested in the artist's sensibility, especially hers, because she really celebrates ordinary things. So she's looking at those spaces, as with the child, that we now overlook. And so we looked at, for instance, this glowing area, which was where the garbage was. And we really spent some time looking. And what we found there, actually, was this couch that she drew. Alfred Kazin, writing about walking in early 20th century New York City, talked about the nude, shamed look of furniture that's left out in the garbage. Under our gaze, though, it seemed to turn elegant again, just to be looked at and to imagine its past history, and then to be drawn by Myra. Myra also changed how I viewed space in the city. So one of the things that she did was go into spaces that I, who had lived around the corner from our walk, had never been into. And she made me aware of how there's a collision of private and public spaces in the city. We carry with us this very private, personal space that we don't want anyone to invade. We're walking on public space, meaning city sidewalks, that's public space, which are incidentally the responsibility of the private building owner who abuts that space. There are private ownership items along the sidewalk, newspaper bin, the post office, the post box, that's sort of private and public at the same time. Most buildings are private, but if it's a co-op, for instance, actually none of the building is owned by the residents of the building, just the sort of abstract idea of the building up to the interior walls. And what Myra showed me was that if there's a private building but the door is open, it might be a building that welcomes the public. And so we went into a lot of these spaces that I hadn't before. She had, I think, a kind of childlike vision that allows her to visit the scenes we see and image them differently. Maybe you've seen these around the city. These are now, well, you should, because they're now on a lot of corners, reminding us to, you know, look for cyclists and pedestrians and cars. And I think it's actually the city doing my advertising for me, because this book is about that. I think we've forgotten how to look all the time. And it's extremely enriching to look at the city as something which has a lot of things available if you bring attention to just one kind of aspect. And that's what all of these people were letting me do. I do fear sometimes that I'm coming off as admonishing everybody, you must attend. You can't think about dinner. Look at the limestone. But I'm not, and I know that even the best attenders miss things. And this was well represented to me on one of my very first walks that I took with a psychologist of attention who studies mindfulness and is quite renowned for this. And we were walking and talking about mindfulness, which is the process of trying to bring new attention to a familiar thing to see it in a different way. a very similar concept to the concept of this book. And as we were walking, I was a half step behind her, and I suddenly noticed that I stepped over a $20 bill on the street. And then I noticed another $20 bill, and then a third, which was highly unusual for me. And the most unusual thing is that she had walked right by them all. So no one sees everything. What we see is what we expect to see. So what I'd like you to do is to expect to see more in this city of ours. There's no mandate, but there is a lot of opportunity. Thank you very much. I'm happy to respond to any questions. Yes.
I'm interested in how the experience of writing this book has changed you, and because we all do experience things, come to light with our own expertise or lack thereof. Do you walk around now totally, completely overwhelmed?
One might fear that, but no. First of all, this you can easily turn this ability off, right? This is a superpower you can turn off. I do a lot of walks where I'm not looking, but anytime I want to look at something, I feel like I'm equipped with a way to, and it really is a great salve of boredom, you know? And I already love walking, but to be able to turn attention to one kind of repeating motif on the street, for some reason, just that fact alone, you know, makes it enjoyable. Like I'm a kind of collector of, you know, concatenations of concepts. So the street is widely available with them. So that I've been changed in that. And I also, as you mentioned, was changed in this notion that of imagining others' perspectives. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to imagine a dog's perspective and another animal's perspective. But what I was reminded of with these people, I literally cold called dozens of people and said, "Hello, would you like to walk around the block with me?" Which was an unusual proposition. And some people did not. But what I got the feeling from the people I picked was that, you know, I could have taken anybody. And if the only thing I really needed to do was get them to talk to me about what they could see, that they thought maybe they had a special vision on, or even if they didn't think they had a unique sensibility. Because, of course, everyone has their own expertise, or at least their own developmental history, right, which lets them notice parts of the environment that I do not. So I'm quite appreciative of the fact that there's this richness in others' perspectives, you know, with everybody coming at you on the street. Yeah.
I'm confused about the names. Was it Bertram or Lorber or something? He's a psychologist, I think.
Well, the doctor was Bennett Lorber. Yeah, yeah.
What was he testing for? You described how he tests, but what is he looking for?
Well, if he has to...
What problem does he solve?
When he looks for... Well, he's a physician, you know, and he actually is interested in microbiology, but he's also when he'll do rounds with medical students and they'll do physical exams. So they're just trying to get a survey of, just as when you go to the physical exam, of what the state of your health is. And there are lots of ways you can do that, you know, blood work, and maybe you need to have some kind of test. But he likes to just shake someone's hand and see what the strength of their shake. I was very fearful about shaking his hand. I noticed my fingernails were ridged in a funny way right before we met, and I thought, oh man, what does that tell you? What that tells about the person's general overall demeanor, but gait is enormously revealing because anything with a spine will be transferred through gait. All sorts of health elements will be in one's gait, and I can't tell you all of them. But what I do see is a huge diversity of gaits in the street, and I hadn't appreciated it quite at the same way. And with a disease with aspirated tissue, again, there's something that the smell might be an additional hint as to what the disease is the person is suffering from. Yeah.
Yeah.
We both noticed that we noticed a lot of things that we would never notice if we weren't going so slowly.
Right.
That was on one side.
Yeah.
I recently have become bald. and what has surprised me is that
how good we are at turning off what we see. It's, and even the dogs do that.
It's true.
Defensive. You know, yeah. You can turn it on again, but it's habitual and defensive in a sense. What has startled me is that all these people that I kind of assume don't see and have been helping me in ways I have never thought about being helped.
Mm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They have noticed ways to help me that I haven't noticed I might need. And it's quite startling and very pleasing. But
well, that's delightful that you can find something pleasing in your own.
It's their perception.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your.
It's all ages. I mean, from 3 years old to 90.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of wonderful, actually, to hear. I do think we see a lot, but we're not always attending to it. And in other words, what's happening is that we let a lot in on our periphery, and it's quite adaptive to mostly tune all of that out. But with a little release of the pressure that we're about to be attacked by the lion or that we need to make it to work or whatever it is, I think we can let those things in, right? But we're just very practiced at not letting them in as well. And I like your example of the slowing down. That's how easy it is. Actually, to become a tourist in your own neighborhood is to just go a different pace. That's amazing to me that, or, you know, have you ever tried crossing to the other side of the street, you know, or looking up? That's one of the great strategies. Almost everyone I walked with said, oh, I think you should look up more. And actually, right, you know, most of the decorative, if you're interested in architecture, most of the decorative work on every building is above the first floor. You know, so we wind up staring at the subway, and the McDonald's and the nail salons. But right above that is this amazing filigree work or whatever it is. So it's going more slowly is one way to enjoy the city. Yeah.
Did I hear you refer to someone who wrote about walking in New York in the early 20th century?
Alfred Kazin, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
Kazin, yeah. Yeah. You know, this great, he wrote great essays about just traveling through New York, yeah. Yeah.
A few years ago, the Times did a piece, and they said that there was no computer sophisticated enough, at least at that time, to program as successfully as you program yourself crossing the intersection at 72nd and Broadway. The subtleties and the instantaneous exigencies are just not culpable by anything other than human sensibility. Have you come upon anything like that?
Well, I haven't, although I'm not at all surprised. There's a lot that computers cannot do. But the walking on Fifth Avenue, you know, Holly White was looking at the type of dance we do, that you have thousands of people proceeding down a block over the course of a couple of minutes, and there are no major collisions, is kind of incredible because not all of those people are well-trained, right? They don't actually know how to walk in crowds. They just follow a couple of little rules. And so then imagine if we actually did get trained. That's what I think of. What if we trained pedestrians, and then we'd all be very efficient walkers? Yeah. There were so many things, actually, but I think I was really stunned by the limestone, not knowing about ancient worm tracks, you know, right in front of my building. That seemed to me alarming. When you go places to see fossils, right? You don't just look at the building as you're closing the door. And I also, just the fecundity of insect life and diversity. I mean, as any gardener will tell you, you know, constantly battling against these insects. But it was so impressive. And to see that you could, just approach any surface and find the sign of something there, a web on a wall or little egg cases underneath a leaf or track of sidewalk ants or burrows where worms went in the ground. I mean, just it's constant and it's so impressive. You know, I really admire these little guys. Trying to make them my friends. Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Hi.
I look at buildings and yeah. Places to be the creation of people. That's my question. My question is, what do you look at? I mean, if we would have walked with you, what do you look at?
That's great. Well, I think now it's really a pain to walk with me because I find all those things out. You know, I want to talk about all the levels on which I have a new kind of attention. So that's the pedestrians, that's the, you know, the, what's on the surface of things, that's the where the places where the wildlife might be in a few hours' time, but you don't see any right now. But I think the thing I look at the most is dogs. I mean, I'm very interested in the social life of dogs, basically, and how they interact with each other, and how they're approaching each other, and how the person attached to the dog by a leash tries to change and mediate that interaction. So I'm very attentive to that. And now I have a young son, so I look at people that height and what they can see and what they're experiencing of the world. And it's just like with the dog, just thinking about smell gets you smelling more. You know, looking at something from a different vantage gets you remembering that there's a lot, you know, at 2 feet and at 7 feet. So I've looked at different altitudes more. I think that's what I would show you, but maybe we should walk together. Thanks.